is Jeff Spittler, March 24th, 2002, A Tale of Two Kingdoms, number 63, Bothwell Bridge. Okay, let's see, last week we started by discussing some biblical arguments for and against the killing of Sharp. We covered the Ruther Glen Declaration, which was on the anniversary of the Restoration, where they put out some of these celebratory bonfires and then publicly burned, started their own bonfire, publicly burning Acts of the Parliament Privy Council. We introduced John Graham of Claverhouse, who shortly thereafter had a chance to demonstrate his military prowess or lack thereof when he caught up to a party of Covenanters 3 days after the Ruther Glen Declaration. And this was near the small village of Drumclog, where due to his sorry horse he had to flee for his life, and the Covenanters were victorious. They encamped near a bridge over the Clyde at Bothwell, where they organized several forays into Glasgow, one time burning Lauderdale's mansion and the houses of some of the prelates. They numbered as many as 8,000 men at some times, but there was a division in the camp, and as described by Hewison, there were at least four different factions in the camp. The Hamiltonian Cargillite / Cameronian party. Right? Cameron was in Holland at the time, but Hamilton was closely aligned with him philosophically, theologically. He was leading the military force, and Donald Cargill was actually there at the battle. There were two different factions of field preachers favoring more or less moderate courses of action, and there were also the camp hanger honors who were just looking for a fight. And we left off right on, literally on the eve of the battle. The the Duke of Monmouth came from England, and he just sort of arrived. And there were quite a few more from the king's troops than there were Covenanters. So let's see, picking up right on the eve of the battle. There were very few military men among the Covenanters. Robert Hamilton took command of the operation based on his success at Drumclog. And sometime during the month of June, they were joined by Captain John Patton. That's with one T, otherwise a very venerable military name. He was a veteran of the Civil Wars in Raleigh and Green, but otherwise there was very little military expertise available. Hewison says, instead of entrenching a league or gathering munitions, appointing officers, the leaders turned the camp into a general assembly of the hottest heads. Like stump orators, the perfervid demagogues carried their pulpits with them. One little brass gun filched from Douglas Castle with a few charges was all their artillery. The Hamiltonian Cargillite party wanted a day of mourning and a stand taken against the defections of the day, including the indulgences. All right, but the more moderate parties objected to that. They they wanted to try to have a show of unity even with the indulged ministers. The moderate parties wanted to put together a testimony to the effect that their insurrection against the government was not a proof of disloyalty. The Hamiltonian Cargillite party objected. Although they hadn't fully yet disowned the authority of Charles II, they were very close to doing so, and they didn't want to be a party to any such declaration. Nevertheless, the moderates did produce such a declaration. They posted it at the market cross at the nearby town of Hamilton on the 13th of June. It was then put into print in Glasgow. And then later you'll find that the Cargillites or Cameronians, etc. Later, one of the things they disown is this Hamiltonian declaration. But this caused further dissension, arguing in the Covenant forces right up to the moment the battle was joined on the 22nd of June. Okay, Monmouth had arrived in Edinburgh on the 18th. It took several days to join up with the Linlithgow's forces, which were at Stirling, and arrive at Bothwell. On the 20th, an additional 1,000 men from Galloway arrived on the Covenanter side. One of them said, interestingly, that it was the Cameron was the stay, meaning that was what
the sort of Cameronian side was what kept more men from coming out. Could be. Let's see, a council of war was held on the 21st where the moderates wanted to select new officers, but they were unable to reach any agreement. Hamilton and his officers retained control. The Covenanters held the south side of the river and bridge. Monmouth's forces, 10,000 strong, approached from the north, arriving on Saturday evening, the 21st of June. By now, all the arguing had reduced the Covenanters to about 4,000 men. They were separated by the river with a narrow bridge between them, and the bridge was barricaded with stones. On Sabbath morning, the 22nd of June, some minor shooting started back and forth. The Covenanters sent two envoys over carrying an address to Monmouth, who, should be said, let's see, he was a natural or bastard son of the king. He was by no means the worst actor in all this. He actually treated them sympathetically, but firmly. Well, look what just blew in. And later tried to encourage the government to grant an indemnity and so on. He was by no means the worst of the government's men. Let's see. He'd been instructed to act with toleration. His powers were unlimited, and he had authority to pardon all except the forfeited and the slayers of Sharp. They returned with the message that he would only negotiate with them if they laid down their arms first, and Hamilton's cynical reply was that, yes, and hang next. Let's see. For an actual account of the battle, we'll turn to Hewison. Or we could just go on and say the Covenanters were routed. I don't know, one or the other. The English park of artillery was trained on the bridge and the foe, and when the gunners fired, the musketeers and the brass piece, right, that would be the Covenanter side, replied with such effect that the timid royalists abandoned the guns. Incredible to tell, there was no brave Dingwall ready to leap the barricade and spike the guns. They were manned again and soon made a way for the pioneers. Haxton, Ure of Shargarden, and the men of Kippen and Galloway clung to their post for 2 hours or more, and they were set up right at the end of the bridge, calling out for supports and ammunition and being supplied with raisins till they were forced to retire, with sore hearts fighting as they retreated. Hamilton practically forbade a reply, and he didn't reinforce the bridge, and to this day there's really no explanation why. Had he not been both incompetent and in the sulks, he would have reinforced the heroes, who with a keg of powder might have blown the bridge into the river. On a rising ground on the edge of the moorland where the great public gibbet? I don't know if it's a hard G or not. Of the nether ward of Lanark stood what was posted the sullen horde of conventiclers, without a leader, helpless as a drove of sheep, while the army of Monmouth, headed by himself, marched across the bridge in unbroken order. Linlithgow was colonel of the foot guards. Montrose was colonel of the horse guards. On the first discharge of the cannon, the horses on both wings of the insurgents' main body grew restive and stampeded, and before 10 men were killed in the action, the foot was disordered as well. It was now 10 o'clock. Monmouth loosed the cavalry under Oglethorpe Main and Claverhouse, and their thirsty swords completed the debacle. Hamilton was the first to flee. Claverhouse was among the last to quit the scene of slaughter, where he and his troop, mad for blood, did the most cruel execution. When we fled, there was not 10 men killed of us all, Ure recorded. Some fugitives who sought safety in the parish church of Hamilton were butchered in the sacred edifice. Before the dragoons could be got to desist from slaying, some were knocked down by gentlemen of the Life Guard. From Haxton's account of the fight, we learned that after he and the other defenders of the bridge had been compelled to fall back upon the main body of Covenanters, and as the Royalist troops filed across the bridge, there was a movement of the Covenanters, which was checked by the cry that their officers had deserted them. This was followed by a stampede of two troops of horse under Thomas Weir of Greenrigg, formerly a trooper under Delisle at Pentland, apparently done willfully to disorder the ranks of the infantry, as well as in the main body as in the reserve on the left wing. Credit was given to Peyton, far away on the borders, for seeing a vision which made him refuse to preach and constrained him to send the people to pray, as he saw the soldiers hagging and hashing them down and their blood is running like water. It is not to the credit of the hair-splitting heroes that all escaped with sound skins, excepting Balfour, who was shot in the thigh, and Cargill, who was left for dead on the field and miraculously escaped death. I guess this isn't covered here. Cargill was captured by two soldiers, and they asked him if he was a minister, and he said yes, and asked him his name, Donald Cargill, and they let him go, apparently in the dark. Hamilton and his craven staff slept in Loudon Castle that night. Kidd was caught in the first bog. Many of the fugitives, Kidd was a minister, many of the fugitives found refuge in the woods round Hamilton. Some innocent persons were killed in the chase. Monmouth personally did not follow far and mercifully restrained the pursuers. On riding to Crookedstone near West Quarter, the Dungeons met and slew William Gordon of Earlston, a notorious old conventicler who turned to exile and outlaw on his way to join his son Alexander, who married Janet, only sister of Robert Hamilton. Alexander fled into a house in Hamilton and, disguising himself as a woman rocking a cradle, escaped the searchers. Hundreds were slain in town and field. Few royalists fell. A large body of Covenanters, seemingly converted to a policy of non-resistance, gave up their arms without striking a blow. According to Blackadder, after the retreat was sounded, they fell on taking prisoners, which were about 1,200 on the place, who were all gathered together under a gallows that stood there and kept in that place all night, made to lie flat on their faces on the ground with a strong guard. He also mentions the barbarities with which they were treated. They were stripped. The wounded were prevented getting water until some humane officers interfered. Monmouth, with the feelings of a true cavalier, spurned the counsel attributed to Claverhouse and Major White that all the prisoners should be put to death. And this humanity was afterwards animadverted upon both in Scotland and at court. The Duke of York thought what the king afterwards said, that if he had been there, they should not have had the trouble of prisoners. Right? The Duke of York is the king's brother, and to this Monmouth made a true soldier's reply. He could not kill men in cold blood. That was only for butchers. So, the 1,200 some prisoners were marched to Edinburgh, where they were taunted with "Where's your God?" When they arrived, there not being enough room in the common prisons, they were penned in the Greyfriars churchyard. It looked pleasant enough when we were there in 1997. And it now has a little sign on it that says Covenanter's Prison. But it was open to the weather until in the winter they put up some sheds. And even in the summer in Scotland, it can get pretty miserable. So, eventually, as additional prisoners were captured, their number grew to 1,500. They had poor food and poor water. Naturally, the Privy Council enacted a proclamation against rebels that declared 65 of the leading insurgents to be traitors, making it a crime to harbor or have the slightest dealings with them. The king issued his own proclamation, which approved the transportation of 300 to 400 prisoners, right, transport them to the colonies or the West Indies, and concluded by giving increased powers to all our other judicatures to pursue and punish with all the severity that the law can allow threateners of clergy, murmurers against courts and crown officials, and disseminators of criticisms. Every trooper's, according to Hewison, every trooper's blade was now whetted, and every militiaman's fusil was charged anew. Okay, I mean, if you can punish people for being a murmurer against courts or a disseminator of criticism, then, you know, it's pretty much an open license to do whatever you'd like. Let's see, the king's proclamation also offered some indemnity to the prisoners if they were willing to admit they'd been in rebellion and take an oath to be peaceful. A number were released, and a significantly large number also refused to take that oath, particularly to admit they'd been in rebellion, because they didn't consider themselves to be in rebellion. Unfortunately, those who were released received no written proof of their discharge. And at home, they found themselves to be suspects and still chargeable under other statutes. Furthermore, frustrated with not finding Sharpe's executioners who were still on the run, Burleigh or Balfour had been shot in the thigh. He would escape to Holland in October. A number of the other conspirators, such as Haxton, did escape the country. The king ordered that they hang 9 prisoners at Magus Moor. And to select the sacrificial goats, as it were, the prisoners were asked questions whether or not the Bothwell Rising had been rebellion, whether or not the Archbishop's killing was murder. And two no answers was good enough to get you on the short list for that. Two field preachers had been captured, John Kidd and John King. King, you might recall, had been captured by Claverhouse and then set free at Drumclog. The Privy Council tortured Kidd with a boot, hoping to uncover a vast conspiracy, but were unsuccessful. They were convicted and sentenced to death for being present at conventicles and carrying arms. On the morning of the 14th of August, a royal indemnity was proclaimed, commanding all our judges to interpret this our remission and indemnity with all latitude and favor. And that afternoon, the interpretation of it took the form of the two preachers, as Hewison says, dangling with all possible longitude at the same cross where the royal indemnity had been proclaimed in the morning. Interestingly enough, one little anecdote is the Covenanters didn't even, being marched out to death, didn't lose their sense of humor. King said that he'd often heard of a kid sacrifice, a young goat being sacrificed. So. A little bit of gallows humor, I guess. Let's see. On the 18th of November, five prisoners were hanged at Magus Moor, and then they were wrapped in chains and left to rot there. Let's see, on the 15th of November, 257 prisoners were loaded onto a ship to be transported to the plantations. Let's see, they were locked in the hold of the ship. And the only thing I figure is this must have been roughly either equivalent to like the slave trade, or maybe it was a slave trader. I'm not sure who would agree to take such a cargo. I mean, you're taking 257 prisoners, so presumably you have to, have a crew that's willing to take security and so on. They were locked in the hold. For 12 days they rocked at anchor, and then they tried to get out to sea. For 12 more days they were battered by strong seas. This was now into December. They were trying to cross. They're trying to cross the north coast of Scotland through the Pentland Firth. So they were battered for 12 more days, and finally they anchored in the Orkney Islands at a place called Scarva Teng. And the ship was destroyed at anchor, and the captain and crew got out, but they kept the prisoners locked in. And the ship broke up in the water, and most of the prisoners drowned. Perhaps as many as 50 escaped alive. Supposedly, some of them climbing ashore on rocks were beaten up by the captain and crew. And speaking of prisoners transported to plantations, Bruce had asked about whether or not the ones transported to Virginia had any later influence on events. And I haven't really found any useful information, except that in one case where the prisoners were transported to Jamaica, New Jersey, very few, if any, survived to the Revolution of 1688. I've read in a few other cases where men came home after 1688, so that's all I know right now. During the summer after the battle at Bothwell Bridge, a third indulgence was offered. Maurice Grant says, like the earlier indulgences, this last measure generated its share of controversy, but the situation in 1679 was radically different from what it had been in earlier days. The church was now in a seriously weakened condition. In the aftermath of Bothwell, the leading field preachers had fallen silent or had left the country. John Welsh had retired to London, where he was to remain till his death in 1681. Donald Cargill and Thomas Douglas had gone to Holland. Cameron was already in Holland. The others judged it prudent, the situation prevailing after Bothwell, not to provoke the authorities into further acts of repression. They also, quite understandably, feared for their own safety. The act proclaiming the third indulgence had reaffirmed the previous severe laws against field meetings, including the death penalty for preachers, and the condemnation as traitors of all who attended such meetings carrying arms. In such an atmosphere, it was scarcely surprising that a mood of compromise prevailed. Some of the ministers in Edinburgh made it their business to visit the Greyfriars churchyard and persuade the remaining prisoners to take the bond for the peace. At a general meeting of ministers on 16 September,
It was agreed that the third indulgence could be accepted without compromise of principle, and a number of ministers, some of them former field preachers, were settled in parishes on bonds of 6,000 merks each. They called that meeting on the 16th of September. They called a general assembly. I don't think there weren't all that many ministers present, but anyways, Grant goes on. By the autumn of 1679, resistance to the government had been well nigh overcome. The confrontational tactics of Robert Hamilton had ended in disaster. Through persecution and compromise, the church had been virtually brought into submission. Everywhere, the forces of repression appeared to be triumphant. That their triumph did not become complete was largely due to the efforts of one man who had been remote from the scene of action, but was now, who was now preparing once again to return to his native land. That's Richard Cameron. Or, as J.D. Douglas said, one result of the 1679 uprising was the elimination of the moderate Covenanters as a vital force in the country. And he went on to say, oppression once more had its natural consequences. Wild men were made wilder, and control of the resistance movement passed completely into the hands of the extremists. So this is really, Bothell Bridge is sort of the, I guess you could say, the high water mark for field preaching and so on. After this, there was very... very little field preaching. When Cameron returned, and Cameron and Cargill and Douglas returned, they did some, but there was really very little going on in the country. So, we returned to that man, Richard Cameron, who'd been in Holland. And the news of the battle had been carried abroad both by newspapers and correspondents. The Scots exiles in Holland were fully aware of what happened. McWard said to Cameron, Richard, the public standard of the gospel has fallen in Scotland, and if I know anything of the mind of the Lord, you are called to undergo your trials before us and go home and lift the fallen standard and display it publicly before the world. But before you put your hand to it, you shall go to as many of the field ministers as you can find to give them your hearty invitation to go with you. And if they will not go, go you alone, and the Lord will go with you. Okay, the trials that McWard was referring to were the examinations prior to ordination. Right, Cameron had been licensed as a probationary preacher. And so they were proposing and did ordain him. This was a somewhat unusual action. They would usually ordain a minister only to a particular charge or church that he was going to be minister of. If we go back to the Westminster form of church government, which was the standard of the Church of Scotland, it says, it is agreeable to the word, very expedient, that such as are to be ordained ministers be designed to some particular charge or other ministerial charge. And for scriptural proof, they cite the passages in Acts where Paul and Barnabas ordain elders in every church. Let's see, in Titus, where Paul mentioned this, Titus was to have ordained elders in every city. And in Acts 20, where Paul is speaking to elders, reminding them of their role to protect the flock. In other words, an individual flock, not... from an individual church. The form of church government also mentions that in extraordinary cases, something extraordinary may be done until a settled order may be had, yet keeping as near as possible may be to the rule. And interestingly, that's the Westminster Divine cited 2 Chronicles 29 and 30, where Hezekiah was restoring the worship of God, and everything couldn't be done exactly as specified. I'm sure Dr. Knowles had more to say on that in the past. Okay, so sometime in late July or August 1679, Cameron was ordained by McWard, John Brown of Warmfray, and a Dutch minister in Rotterdam. I think, if I remember right, Brown died later that fall. Okay, we have to read an account of this ordination. It says, the procedure followed the traditional practice of imposition of hands, with the officiating ministers laying their hands on the head of the candidate for ordination, token of his investment in the office of the ministry. It was precisely at this point in the service that a most striking event took place. As he and the others laid their hands on Cameron's head, McWard had a sudden vision of the future. So intense and vivid was it that he lost all sense of time and place.
No longer was he in the Scottish church in Rotterdam on that summer day in 1679, but on an Ayrshire moorland on a day in July 1680. This was the day that he's referring to as the day Cameron was killed. Just as suddenly, the scene shifted to the High Street of Edinburgh a few days later, where one sight above all others fixed itself on his attention. And that would be Cameron's head on a spike. As the vision faded and consciousness of his surroundings returned, McWard, alone of the three, kept his hands firmly placed on Cameron's head. Then, turning to those assembled, he called out, "Behold, all you beholders, here is the head of a faithful minister and servant of Jesus Christ, who shall lose the same for his master's interest, and it shall be set up before sun and moon in the public view of the world."
So, that's an interesting account of ordination. So. And indeed, that's what happened. And you'll find when you read these histories that there are a lot of accounts like this, you know, about Peyton and so on. And it's an interesting subject. I guess I don't have a lot more comment on it. I think Chris Coldwell have an article on this sort of what do you call it? Prophetic aspects of the So Alan could point you to it if. Or I might even be able to find it. It's in the blue banner. Is that? Okay. Okay. Well, we could dig it up if you're interested. Okay, so Cameron returned to Scotland via Newcastle in late August, early September. He headed to southwest Scotland and he started to reconnoiter. Almost immediately when he returned, people started to ask him to preach. They were cowed by the persecution, but they still desired to hear a faithful preacher preach. And Cameron had, by McWard's advice, planned to seek out some faithful field preachers for advice. So he initially refrained from preaching. He went on to Edinburgh to seek advice. When he arrived, he could only find two of them, John Dixon and Thomas Hogg of Kiltern. Hogg had spent 2 years on the Bass Rock, but had been released in the general indemnity of the summer. And both felt it was too dangerous to preach in the fields. Dixon had already written McWard with the news that the General Assembly, meeting on 16th of September, had voted to accept the third indulgence. Cameron wrote to McWard asking for his advice, and McWard gave the following, which read from his parts of his letter here. "I must tell you, brother," this is McWard writing to Cameron, "I have heard of practices which I am sure that great field preacher, the Prince and Savior, will never approve, that when some had traveled far to hear sermon, and the room being full ere they came, so that there was no place for them, after all their wandering, they were forced to return." Okay, this third indulgence and indemnity had allowed for preaching in houses. So there was actually a room there. If there was room in the house for everyone, then it was okay. "For my own part, I had rather have obtained the mercy of dying for preaching in the fields than have so offended one of these little ones. Alas, alas, that the people of God should in that matter particularly see us walk as men and not rather as those who so preach and persuade the things pertaining to the kingdom of God as not regarding our own lives. Yea, as rejoicing to be offered upon the sacrifice and service of their faith. But, brother, because you have spoken with those great men, Mr. Hogg and Mr. Dixon, that I may not seem to rush you into a contradiction to their advice for the present, which I should account rashness in me, I shall offer you in my opinion in the case. And I durst not do otherwise, be the consequence what it might." So, McWard went on to give some advice for preaching. He advised him to show all readiness and cheerfulness among the people to preach in the fields upon a call to it. "Nay, the necessity that is now upon you not to decline it in point of testimony." And that when he appeared ready and willing to prevent their stumbling, "I would have yourself and some of the more judicious in the bounds where you are called to preach set some time apart seriously to seek the Lord for light leading how to appear with most advantage to his work. Then thirdly, after serious seeking with God, I would have you acquaint your friends that you are to preach at such a place and house. If any house will thereabout be willing to receive you and able to contain such as come, then preach in the house. But if not, then look on yourself as called of God to imitate him who gave you the commission by preaching in the fields, yea, and as called by that deed to witness against that stated enemy to the work of God and those assemblers."
He went on, if people should resolve to come from so many airts or directions to hear, and this were evident to you by such as called you, I could never scruple to appoint any place in the fields where these judicious persons thought it most convenient. Yea, I would do it, and bless him that he hath put it upon the hearts of the people to come and own him in the face of so much hazard from a fierce and furious enemy. As this would stop the mouths of such as are ready to reproach, as if you affected the fields in opposition to house, that you might be reputed singular, so it would prevent the people stumbling, yea, endear you to them. And as I am persuaded, Christ will look upon it as your testimony to him. So you shall have peace, peace, sweet peace, yea, peace swelling over its banks, arising to the height of joy unspeakable and glorious in your soul, amidst the work of what can befall you from the stated enemy in these assemblers. Okay, so, you know, I think he instructed him to, to the extent possible, to comply with the law, if he could preach in a house, to do so, but when not possible, to preach in the fields. He said, in the meantime, be busy instructing and teaching from house to house, and then I hope the success shall be such as will quickly determine the question and force you to the fields. So,
that was McWard's advice, and Cameron did start, he resumed preaching in the fields, and on the first Sabbath he had 3,000 hearers, and on the next 4,000. News that he was preaching began to spread. Grant notes that though many were glad to hear that he was preaching, others were deeply and bitterly resented Cameron's mission, and by none was he more strenuously opposed than by moderate Presbyterians. They remember how he had been a cause of division before Bothwell, and feared that he would once again stir up the fires of division at a time when they believed it was essential to preserve unity and to avoid aggravating the authorities. Cameron was accused of rashness and impetuosity, of thrusting himself forward without regard for the consequences, and of exposing his hearers to needless difficulty and dangers. These attacks were in their own way a reflection of the decline that had taken place in the Church's witness since Bothwell Bridge, and an evidence of the corrosive place of compromise, or the corrosive effect of compromise. So, in fact, despite his instructions and his, you know, trying to do things in a way that would, you know, as much as possible comply with the law and so on, you can see people still blamed him for needlessly exposing his hearers to danger and so on. Okay. I think we'll probably stop right there. I think that's a reasonably good place. Questions? No questions. Well, we can go on then. Oh, Bruce.
I was thinking about maybe we're not far enough in the events to reflect back on. I mean, was there anybody who was reflecting back on the this battle and how poorly it went, and saying, because the accusation there is, where's your God now? To address that. How did they reconcile the fact that they had
whooped? Well, I think Hamilton, I'm not sure about every other one, but a lot of them felt it was due to compromises that had been made. You know, you certainly make the military argument that it was due to poor leadership. I haven't seen too... Basically, what I can see afterwards is most of the sort of more moderate Presbyterians kind of gave up and were peaceable, and they certainly weren't arguing for more military action. And the more extreme ones viewed basically that they had sinned by compromising and failing to issue a clear testimony and so on. So that.
So they're. You know, the tendency then is for these type of things to always move towards a more extreme. Tend to interpret, well, the reason God didn't help us was because
we weren't extreme enough. Yeah.
But then you encourage all the people who compromise that you group, and it tends to move towards a more radical. I mean, I'm thinking the same thing on Islam. The tendency there is to be more radical, because every time something happens that's bad, the excuse that's given is, well, it's because we're not doing things just exactly right. Well, so you get more radical.
Well, as I think Douglas pointed out, that the oppression tends to make wild people wilder. Right? There's sort of a natural tendency, because as you keep ratcheting up, the people who are more moderate sort of eventually fall from the scene, and you have left only the people who are very extreme.
Was there any sort of civil leadership at Bothwell Bridge, or was it just these various factions of basically clergy who were trying to patch this thing together? In other words, did they have any sort of government that they were trying to put in place or trying to follow, or was this just?
Well, this was. First of all, it wasn't just clergy, but otherwise they didn't have a government. That was part of their problem, right? That's why they were spending all their time arguing. There was no lesser magistrate, as it were. But in the nature of the case, I mean, that I think is often the situation when you're faced with extreme persecution, right? I mean, take the last century, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Maybe he was wrong for trying to kill, to be a part of a plot to kill Hitler. I mean, but they certainly didn't have a lesser magistrate to work under. I mean, they were men pushed to, because they had no other possible alternative. Right? There was no way to do anything. I mean, if you were going to do something, that's how it'd have to be done.
How did the commanders arrive? Were they the people who were actually in charge at the end of the day, these four factions? Were they self-appointed? Were they military? Were they nobility? How did they come to a place of power, what little they had?
Well, it was something like you'll recall, I won't mention the name, but the graduate student that we had at Illinois who's family did everything by who could argue the most. it's somewhat unclear, and I think that was part of their problem. I mean, they had no. Certainly wasn't a democracy. They didn't put out polling booths, to see among the forces who would do that. It was. There were sort of leaders, I guess you could say, of every faction, and I think they tried to settle it themselves. But even that, they couldn't really settle. When this additional 1,000 men came that were supporting Welsh, they came from Galloway, that's when they thought they should appoint new leaders, but they didn't appoint new leaders. And I think this is part of the problem. They had Hamilton was he'd been a landowner, so I mean not. He would have been from the, say, leadership class of society anyways. Not the upper echelon. I mean, he wasn't a duke or anything like that, but he at least was a landowner, not just a farm worker or something. He'd been successful at Drumclog, marshaling the forces and commanding them. That's how he got to be the commander here. But beyond that, no, I mean, I think this is part of the problem. They were just arguing back and forth. They didn't really have any means, but I mean, keep in mind, they'd been pushed to that. It wasn't as if the church had been allowed to, say, keep meeting and have, maintaining a regular general assembly that could meet in a regular manner, and decide these things. They didn't. And that's why I said, in the nature of the case, if you go back to like Dietrich Bonhoeffer or something, I mean, tyrants eventually will push out every form of alternative government. So, Mr. Edmondson.
You
know, the idea that they look inside themselves trying to find out why they didn't win. My question was, you said you have to push into this. What was the issue, the basic underlying factors that caused them to be pushed? I mean, there's a lot of other people who are pushed. What caused these men to be pushed into trying to take action? I'm saying is, why did they even think God was on their side? Obviously, they thought they were trapped by a line that takes place. They were along God's path. They were breaking God's commandments or something like that. What was the underlying factor that said, you pushed us too far, this is God will be with us? Why did they even have the presumption God to be with them? Never. I mean, it sounds to me like God was about as far from that group of men and expected. Just the lack of unity and things like that is the lack of, you would just say it didn't seem God to even work on that.
Oh, I mean, I think that's a hard question to answer, but and maybe it's impossible one to answer. But, I mean, you could say apply the same criticism to the Stillwater Reformed Presbyterian Church. I mean, look at us. 90 people. Are we unified with all the other Christians in Stillwater? No. How can we say God's with us? I mean, that's the sort of question and just sort of turned around, that's the sort of way you could say it. I mean, I'm sure the people who felt that they were, quote, spiritually in the right, doing the right thing, say the extremists, thought they were in God's will. And they thought the other people were compromising.
There's a vast difference. Okay.
Between the
differences I'm taking, in this case, for instance, back then, I'm saying that God wants me to go to battle and to be with us. Now, that's essentially what I'm saying when I go to battle. I'm saying that God's going to be in this endeavor. And I'm saying, what made them think that occurred? And then, you brought the two waters, which we're not talking about now.
Well, not exactly, no.
What I'm saying here is, we're meeting, there is no sense that we are saying, I don't think anybody says here that God is looking through all the wrong church and not with the other ones, or so forth and so on. I don't, come on. Maybe we are making claims.
Well, I in terms of whether or not they thought they were going to be victorious, I don't know. I mean, I think I think most of them felt they had to do what they had to do, regardless of what was going to happen.
Why did they think that?
Because to not do that would be to compromise in the cause of Christ. That's why they thought they had to do it.
Didn't most of them have a death sentence on their head already anyway? They've been to the conventicle.
They almost all legally had.
So they were all. These were condemned people. So as soon as they got caught, they were going to get hung.
That doesn't answer the question. They just answered.
Well, so but it does sort of because then it doesn't really matter.
That's a real poor argument to go in the bathroom.
I think it is. But I think that you can see. I mean, I think Jeff's point that these people have been pushed so far, you can see where they just wouldn't care that much. It wasn't like they would say, "Oh well, the Lord is clearly not in this, so I better just." Go home.
Okay, hold on. Let me just restore a little order here. And I'm at the front here, and that's why I'm going to say who can... Mr. Covington is next, then Mr. Rees. Okay.
First off, that was not a military... That was a bunch of people that had gathered together that had some primitive firearms. There was nobody in the leadership who took any kind of look at what they were up against and what is our strategy to... take the strengths and weaknesses that we have and use them to our advantage. I mean, they clearly had the better ground, and even if they had been in inferior numbers, should have been able to carry that battle. Wallace was in similar situations many times and carried the day. The fact that Hamilton, when it got bad, left the scene In no way, shape, or form should he have ever been in charge of
that. Yeah, yeah.
And the people that were following him, at least the leaders of that, should have made it very clear that we're not following you into this. So I think there were egos that were getting in the way. I don't think that the people who were in leadership of this thing were earnestly seeking Christ's direction and protection and anything else. I mean, this was a one-sided battle. You had a bunch of civilians that thought that, well, God will take care of me because it's a righteous cause. Well, God tells you to use your head before you go into battle. I mean, stupidity, I mean, that ought to be the 13th commandment. Stupidity will be punished, whether you...
11, 12. He was in the Navy. He can't repeat 11, 12 for this audience. Well, yeah, that's a good point. But I'm not excusing their sort of military leadership. Obviously, it was poor. But my point is that they were pushed to this, and they really didn't feel like they had any alternatives. Their alternative was to go back home, sit in their cottage, go to the church, hear the curate, not hear the word of God. And that do that was a compromise, and that's the only reason. I mean, that you can say, well, you know, why did they do this? Well, this is why they did it. They didn't feel like they had any other choice, and in the nature of the case, in God's providence, they couldn't come to an agreement. And yes, I'm sure there were egos and everything, but I'm also sure there was also a lot of earnest seeking of Christ. It's just it didn't result in them all sort of coming to one accord and defeating the enemy. You know, sometimes I think what one of the factions, Blackadder, led, said that that they were to glorify Christ in their suffering. I think he was right. That is what happened. They glorified Christ in their suffering. And a few years later, within 10 years, the Stuart, the House of Stuart was overthrown for basically no more reasons than what the Covenanters had in 1679. So, Dr. Reese.
Well, I was just going to take you to you can't say on the one hand, well, these were acted out of some great sense of principle, in defense of the rule of Christ on the one hand. Then on the other hand, say, well, they just went about because they're going to die.
Yeah, but I don't think most of them didn't have that principle.
Okay, well, in that case, there was
There was a lot of
rebellious rabble.
Yeah, there was a lot of rebellious rabble there.
I believe that, actually. We can't have both things at the same time.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's why they couldn't come to agreement, right? Because at least a quarter of them were rebellious rabble.
Well, I don't know that a quarter of them were, but there certainly were some that had. I mean, there were a few that were executed in camp for various things. So, looking back at it and having read a lot on it, it's still very confusing, and it's hard to see exactly how God worked, and they accept through their suffering. That's really how he worked in it, and presumably he had his reasons for not giving them military victory, and presumably it wasn't only because they were stupid. I mean, I think you could say God made them stupid. In God's providence, they were stupid when it came to military battle. It wasn't, I think you can see from the situation, if God wanted to give them the victory, he easily could have given them the victory. They would have stood their ground, they would have held the forces off, and something different would have happened, but that wasn't God's plan.
But I find that God glorifying their suffering, at least we've got a condition there then that you can never be wrong. Because you can never say, if I went into battle saying, if I win, God gave me the win, if I lose, I rejoice in my suffering. So I would never learn from that battle and say, I screwed up. Because, as long as God glorifies, the point I'm getting is, if you don't have this idea that sometimes God packs off that game, the reason I didn't win, because God backed off. I mean, it wasn't so much war bonding. I screwed up. I mean, you're taking the.
But I don't. I don't think the two arguments are mutually exclusive. I mean, God, you know, what's our purpose, right? Well, to know God, to glorify Him, right? And some of us don't know Him, but some of us will glorify God in ways that, you know, we had not planned. You know, by being the. When I say some of us, I'm saying mankind in general, not anybody in this church, I hope, but are, you know, end up glorifying God by being an object of his wrath.
But if you have this concept, let's say I have this concept that if I'm blessed, I'll get $1 million, okay? And if I'm poor, I'm blessed with being poor. Then there's a society of blessing no longer has any meaning. Because a blessing, in order to have any meaning, has to have the opposite of a non-blessing. So, what I'm saying is, we're running in that same sort of scenario under these folks, in the fact that win or lose, I mean, the idea of being blessed in battle, there's no sense. There's no blessing. The idea of blessing loses even a meaning, because there's no way they can lose.
Well, if they went to heaven, then they didn't lose, did they? I mean. You mean should they have looked and said, well, militarily, what did we do wrong? Well, probably, except by and large, after that was sort of the real that was really their last hope from a military standpoint, was that battle. After that, all the moderates dropped out, and all that was left was just a handful. So from then on, I don't think, you know, military strategy or no, I mean, they really didn't have any hope, just on a, you know, sheer numbers. So.
Something like this. Maybe we look at, say, just the idea of a theocracy even with God alone. That's essentially what they're saying. Yeah.
Well, that was one of the issues, right? In their case, they had a modern critics would say they had a theocracy at that time. Charles was head of the church, you know, and so on. So. Yeah, should there's a lot of, you know, ifs and so on about what they should have looked at and should have done, but I don't know that there's a lot of good answers, frankly. That, you know, what happened is what happened. So. Mr. Covington, would you close us in prayer?